Welcome back to the John Williams Show. I'm Frank Fontana. And that is
Sherry Fontana.
Sitting in for John. You guys are listening here on the stream while the White Sox are taking over the airwaves. You know, I do love that voice you do, Ella. I'm not going to make you do it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do you enjoy doing it?
Yeah, actually. I love doing imitations of absolutely everything and everyone, so I don't mind.
Can you do one with me? Yeah, I'd like to.
Sure. Let me just get in the zone. So, I'm here with my wife,
my middle name is Frankie, so.
I'm under pressure. I'm here with my wife, whose middle name is Frankie.
That's pretty good. I like it.
But really quick, before we get into this, can we talk about your shoes?
Oh, sure. Oh, God.
Girl
sure.
Talk. Here we go.
Yeah.
Amazing shoes. As soon as I walked in, I said, wow, those shoes are sweet. And so I give
what
her a compliment.
What do they look like? Give some context
and
to
wait,
it,
hold
please.
On. So I give her a compliment on the shoes, and what was your response?
They're from Paris.
I mean, really? That's amazing.
She's fancy. I mean,
love it.
And yeah, they're silver and black polka dot kitten heels with
kitten
a pointed
heels?
Toe. Yeah.
Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Like what? Like kitten
like
heels?
Like they're like the hardest shoe you'll ever walk on. You wouldn't expect that from a kitten heel. But,
why do girls do that to themselves? I don't understand.
It's not that bad. You get used to it.
So when you're older, your feet look like crinkled like Fritos. And, like, your toes curl up. And
I don't think that's the case.
I've seen a lot of older women toes in my family. They don't look too good.
No, I don't know if that's the reason that their feet look like that now, but I'd love to ask them and see.
Well, they'll be here soon. You can ask.
Elif, continue wearing the shoes. They're amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So, just to answer a couple of these texts, we left off talking about vacations, and we just came back from a little week-long break with the kids up in Michigan City, and people were asking, where did we go? We were up at this place called Beach Walk, which is kind of this Key West community. Somebody just texted in from the 219, did you go to Blue Chip? Why? Did you see me there? Yes, I did. It was fun. I actually liked Blue, so there's two casinos nearby there.
So you did go to Blue Chip.
I did.
And I did not. I was home with the kids watching a movie.
Because your parents forced me to go.
Which leads us into the discussion about finding out what your spouse does on vacation or your friends. Huh. Something, what were you talking about?
Different. Something
different,
unusual.
Something different.
Unknown.
Something unusual. So what were you going to say? Because I'm assuming this is about me. But
it was, yes.
I was not doing something unusual because I was home watching a movie with the kids while Frank was at Blue Chip. But I chose to because I really wanted to make them popcorn.
Because I had to escort her parents. That's why. They needed an escort.
So what was I doing? Because I know this is about me. What was I doing that you didn't expect?
The question I pose is, when you're on vacation with your spouse, friends, or loved ones, and you're there for a little bit of time, and all of a sudden they bust out something that you had no idea they were into, right? Something unusual. So we're in our trip, and my wife decides to stop at a little shop in downtown New Buffalo, and she buys a puzzle. A puzzle. Through the 10 years I've known her, I've never once seen her put a puzzle on a table and do a puzzle. But on vacation, all of a sudden, she busts out a puzzle. And that probably took up about 30% of her time on the vacation. So much so that it was obsessive when her parents came. Her mom got into it, and they were both staring at this thing and while polishing off a bottle of wine. And frustration, that we can't find the right pieces. So to me, it struck me as like, huh. I never knew my wife was into puzzles. What things do people hide from each other
that
get exposed?
That's so therapeutic.
Is it?
And
though?
Wine?
You're in a beach town with a beach 5 minutes away, and you're playing inside on a puzzle.
Well, maybe you don't feel like going out yet.
True.
Well, here is the truth. Okay, this is my truth. I would have much rather been at the beach. But every time we went to the beach, Frank got restless after about an hour.
Which you know about.
And
me.
Then the kids got restless. And then so mom had to pack up everything and head back to the house. So, yes, I bought a puzzle, which I honestly have been, my mom always did puzzles, so I do enjoy them. But for the last 7 or 8 years, I've been nonstop taking care of the children and not have been able to do a puzzle. So now that they're getting a little bit older and I have a little bit more free time, instead of like, you know, going shopping or reading, for me, a puzzle is therapeutic, but you're also using your brain.
Hmm.
And especially if the puzzle is inspiring, it's worth doing and seeing it come together. So yes, I did enjoy it.
Because Potoskis are inspiring.
Potoskis.
Potoskis. That's a real thing, but Elif, I don't know if you know this. You know what a Potoski is?
I'm Googling it right now, and I came up with Joe Nick Potoski, so I don't know what
No, Joe
is.
Wasn't there that day. But, yeah, it's a flower, I think, right?
So, the
puzzle was a whole bunch of flowers.
So here's the thing. The puzzle was a bunch of flowers. It was petals and Potoskis. That was the name of the puzzle. And a Potoski is a type of stone.
Oh, it is.
So it was a stone.
Where was the stone in the whole thing?
It was the gray
Okay.
part of the entire gray part of the puzzle.
So we digress. The point here is that I discovered my wife likes puzzles on vacation. And, you know, it's one of those things you learn in those kind of moments. So I wonder, like, what other people out there have learned on vacations? Give us a text, 312-917-200. We'll read them as long as they're appropriate. Or if they're inappropriate, still send it, because I'd like to laugh quietly.
Well, and I think everyone has a different personality, of course. And I feel like at home, you are able to detach a little bit more. And because you're not a mother, obviously you're the dad, and
yes.
I feel like you're able to detach a little bit more if you want to go to the gym, if you want to go for a walk, whatever it is that is your interest, you are able to do probably easier than I am, which is not negative, it's actually positive. But for me, I have a harder time detaching when I'm at home because I'm tending to the kids so much. So I didn't really learn anything new about you because you pretty much do what you do at home on vacation.
Which is
you're
what?
On vacation every day.
Yeah, right.
I'm kidding about that.
No way. Anyway, but you did have. I see you were on your phone a little bit. I mean, you were surfing like Instagram here and there and checking out like you know.
I really didn't have great service, which was amazing for me.
Yeah, the service was terrible up
which
there,
which I loved.
I, you know, spent maybe 10% of the time on social just looking because of the podcast, which I will be talking about later. Danny the Car Bomb Carcillo from the Stanley Cup winning Blackhawks is going to be joining us at 2 o'clock. Danny is a guest, the very first guest on my new podcast, The Human Renovation Project, which dropped today at noon. It is live on WGN Plus on Spotify. You can go check it out. Danny's going to be joining us to talk a little bit about that interview. A huge revelation from him, and he's so candid in this. You heard bits and pieces of it, Sherry.
I did, and honestly, it's amazing, and I wanted to hear every bit of it.
Thank you.
The promos for it, you know, do it justice because they're great.
Tingles when you
and watch. It's amazing, and his story is amazing, and I think people honestly will love it. So check it out.
Yeah, it'll be good. And Phil Vitale is going to be joining us, good old Phil, talking about what triple threat dining. Ooh, I like it. I'm starving. He'll be coming around 1:35 after the news. But before we do that, I just want to bring this up because we're talking about Instagram. Do you ever feel like there's too many like quotes on Instagram? Do you feel like we're overquoted on Instagram? What I mean by that is like, you know, life is like a box of chocolates, you know, eat as many as you can, whatever, you know, whatever the quote is that is the inspirational quote of the day.
Well, I think if there's a lot of it out there.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, there was a time probably, you know, last year where I was going through a tough period. And so I would find quotes that would resonate. And so I'd follow, you know, the outlet that was posting that.
Right.
And it's funny because now I actually had to delete and unfollow some of them because it doesn't relate to
it's
my life now. So for that reason, I'd say it depends on what you're going through in your life. And maybe it's inspirational and gets you through. And then maybe it's time to, you know, it depends on what you're going through. But there's a lot out there.
I believe there's like an oversaturation of quality quotes. Like, I love the quotes from the authors that we follow, like the Deepak Chopras, the Eckhart Tolles, the Don Miguel Ruiz, Four Agreements. Those like credible sources when it's like reposted and like I'm bringing this up because the other day I was just surfing through and I post inspirational stuff myself. But this particular quote was about relationships and it was like, find the love. I'll dig it up during the break here. It was like, find the love of your life. Love should be blah, 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 perfect and da, 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 da. And it was like,
and then you went on vacation. I was doing a puzzle and you were like, that's amazing.
Yeah. No. So here's the thing. I never respond to those things. I never comment. Never, ever, ever. This one, I was so infuriated by it because everyone else was like, this is what's wrong with the world. This is what's wrong with the internet, is these fluffy quotes that are just not realistic, but set people up in a mindset.
For false expectations.
For false expectations about love and relationships. And my comment is always this. Do you have children? Are you in a real relationship? Because if those two things are real, then you would take this quote and wipe your butt with it, because that's not true. Love is not about being perfect. Love is not about cutting out everything in your life. Love is about enduring the hardest times, because that's the hard stuff. That's the stuff that love is built on, not just the fluffy, perfect moments.
I couldn't agree more, and I've learned that with you for the last 10 years, and but maybe someone who is going through something a little bit different, who maybe is not in a relationship, I could definitely see how it could set up false expectations for people, truly.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe it hits someone in a different way and can help them. I don't know. I'm trying to be positive about it, but I think it's something to think about when you're reading. Just know that everything is not maybe relative and
factual. Well, like you said, I think there is times in your life where it hits you at the right time. And that's what this is all about, like hitting you at the right time. Yeah, I know you're laughing.
No, you are dying
I'm
to
dying.
Read this.
I want to move on.
See,
quick.
No, this is why I know that look, and I looked down at the text, and I know what you're going to say.
So I'm
going to
fast forward here. And if you have any comments about quotes on Instagram, love to hear it. 312-981-7200. Are you overquoted? Do you feel like there's an oversaturation? Are you tired of hearing the fluffy, inspirational stuff? Love to hear your opinion on this. But before we take a break, I got to address this text that just came in. It's from the 847. Why didn't Frank take the kids back to the when he got tired of the beach? Sherry, why don't you answer that question?
Frank did offer to take the kids back to the house, but it's something that I am working on, and you know, allowing myself to take time for myself and put myself first. I'm not very good at that.
What did I say to you as you were packing up the beach?
I felt bad to not spend time with the kids. I'm like, it's a family vacation, and so I appreciate this text, because
so do I.
If Frank didn't offer and that was repeatedly what happened, it would not be a good thing.
Yeah, thank
but
you.
He did offer, and I
thank
have a
you,
hard time doing.
Welcome back to the John Williams Show. John is out. We're streaming live on WGN Plus because the Sox are playing right now. Are they winning, Elif? Or should I say, are you Siri? Can you do Siri?
Let me have a look.
Oh, good. Thanks. In the meantime, joining us in the studio is the one and only Phil Battelle. Phil, you got a new restaurant you want to talk about here, or not quite new, but maybe one that has been splintered.
Exactly. Up in Winnetka, there was, for a good 14 years, there was a restaurant called Restaurant Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And the owner and chef, Michael Lakowitz, also took part of that restaurant a while back and turned it into a single five-table room called George Trois.
Five-table?
Yeah, very exclusive, 200-something a person for wow. dinner, you know, very, very,
fancy.
Very high-end. And he's got the chops for it, so fine. And then later on, he decided he was going to take Restaurant Michael itself, leave George Trois more or less alone, little redecorating job, and turn it into two different restaurants, the first being Aboyer, which is kind of the noisy. Aboyer means to bark in French, so by definition, it's a kind of a noisy place, a brasserie, you know, lots of energy, blah 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 blah,
mm-hmm.
and an a la carte menu, and then the smaller part he called Silencieux, which silence.
Obviously, yeah,
right, it's going to be the quiet one, and that one has like a 5-course menu for $80 or so, $85.
So, do you feel like a concept like that, you know, splitting off, is a obviously, as a restaurateur, he has to have a vision in his mind mm-hmm. from a profitability standpoint to say, still probably one rent, right?
Right.
But three restaurants,
mm-hmm.
probably the same ordering in terms of goods.
Well, that's a good point. It's one of the things he talked about. The tricky balance for him is to have enough similar ingredients that he's not running three inventories at the exact same
mm-hmm.
time, but at the same time have enough differences between what he's putting on the plate
yes.
at each place.
So they're unique enough.
Right. So there's a reason to go to one restaurant rather than go to the other one. The other one isn't just a restaurant with red paint
right.
or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think this is brilliant, really, because like you mentioned, it's a one rent under the same umbrella,
mm-hmm.
but if you, sometimes when you really enjoy a restaurant and you enjoy it because the food is amazing, you want to go back there, but you may get sick of it or you want a different experience. So I feel like you are able to experience the food, but in a different capacity. So I find it to be really interesting and unique.
It's certainly a workaholic's dream.
Yeah,
being a chef over, I assume, one large kitchen, but still having to have all these different things going, the three balls in the air at the same time. He says he's enjoying it. I think it would drive me crazy, but that's probably the reason I don't own one, much less three restaurants.
It's so true.
And but you know, his pride and joy, of course, is George Choi. That's the restaurant that's really, that's the 4-star restaurant. That's the one. But it's a special occasion one. You're going to go there with somebody, and between the two of you, you're going to drop about $500.
Is that the one with five tables?
Mm-hmm. Right, and two of the tables are two tops, so it's really...
So what is is there a wait to get in there?
Depending on the evening, no. There may be, but he staggers the reservations to us. He has no interest in having people waiting for their table to show up. You get a reservation.
At that price point, right?
Right. I mean, if you got that table, they're not going to try to get you out of there in another hour because they got somebody coming in. They don't have somebody coming in. That's your table.
Well, I like that he can say, okay, well, that's full. Mm-hmm. You know, that's booked, but why don't you try this one, perhaps.
Exactly. And so, Aboye is the a la carte, so you can go in there, have a drink, have an appetizer, out the door. That's fine. And you can go there a bunch of times, and he wants to encourage that. And then Silencieux is sort of the in-between. The same kind of, a little more formal, closer to, in concept to George Trois, but at the same time, less than half the price. So you can afford to go there. You have a full course meal, a full course, five courses for $85. I'm not going to say that's cheap for a lot of listeners out there. That's a pretty outrageous price, but, you know, compared to the 200 plus at George Choi. So he's giving people different thresholds, lower thresholds they have to cross.
And is the private tables with the five tables, is that prefixed?
Like, yes, one menu, one set menu, but then you're getting 12 courses. You're getting a little bit of everything, and you're getting the best he's got to offer.
And forgive me, because I don't know this. Is this something that is done, like, in Europe, or in is this a
question,
common thing?
Actually.
Because I really have never heard of this, but I think it's great.
I don't know enough to say that it's unheard of, but I know enough to say that it's not common.
Not common.
Having a chef have two operations at the same time, that's not unusual to have a really high end and then a low end. In Chicago, we have Smith, and then underneath that, the Loyalist. And Smith is your full, you know, main course, 200 plus. And the Loyalist is a cheeseburger. You can get a cheeseburger there and a glass of wine. So that, you know, those are stacked on top of each other.
Sure.
So precedent for that, but this is a different level of ambition, at least for a fairly small operation.
And in Winnetka, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's, and I've been to Winnetka a couple times. There's a couple great restaurants down there that I love. Would you say it's risky in that area? Or you got to imagine the executive chef knows the marketplace well enough to think that this is going to fly.
Well, he's been in the area long enough to know. He's been there 14 years, so he's got some history there. Winnetka is a pretty well-to-do community.
Yes.
A lot of people have serious money out there.
Yeah.
But what I found is people who have serious money didn't get that way by not paying attention to what things cost.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Which is interesting juxtaposition.
Yes.
You
right.
Know?
It is not, you know, it's not a Vegas, oh, what the hell, let's get the $300 bottle of wine kind of place. I mean, the people, they've done very well for themselves, but they know value and they understand, and they're, I said, they didn't get that way by just blithely writing numbers on checks every time somebody asked them to.
Yeah. Hey, Phil, you're in a million different restaurants a year, you know, reviewing and reporting. Do you ever see societal diet trends killing ventures like this? And what I mean by this is, like, the no carb, the low fat, the high fat, the keto, the this, the that. Do these kind of restaurants just transcend all of that and people don't care when you go to a place like this? Or does the dietary trends of the world affect business?
Oh, I'm sure they affect business. There's especially when a new, I could say diet fad, but that would offend somebody.
Right.
But when one of these things comes up, there's a little catch-up time, and then there's a little... There's also a communication thing. I mean, if you're going with a specific diet because of preference, because of ethics, because of medical need, fine. But you communicate that in advance.
Sure.
You go to a place, people say, oh, I'm gluten-free. Where can I go? Oh, well, any steakhouse in America. We'll start with that.
Just about everywhere today, right?
Sure.
Well, gluten-free is pretty easy to manage unless you're at, Clara's House of Pasta. Then maybe you're going to have to do a little maneuvering.
Yeah.
But other than that, I know chefs for a long time were working on gluten-free pastas. You still find it at places like Maggiano's.
Yes.
They have gluten-free pastas.
Yes.
I think gluten-free pasta is a well-intentioned flop, but it's there for people who really want it. My wife tried gluten-free for a while, and just because it was just kind of feeling better without too much gluten, so she avoids bread. It's not, she doesn't pass out if a loaf of bread comes under her, but she avoids it rather than not.
Does she join you when you go out to these restaurants?
Sure.
A lot?
Yeah. And anyway, we taste tested a whole bunch of gluten-free pastas, just looking for that magic, that magic unicorn that would just make
everything
perfect.
How about pizzas, gluten-free pizzas?
The gluten-free pizza, I like when people kind of use a mashed cauliflower crust to kind of whip one of those together.
Yeah, which is not easy to make. I've tried often, and I finally have gotten it down, but it's using a lot less than you would think to actually make the crust.
There's so much moisture in the cauliflower that kills the crispiness.
But I could definitely see, like, being a very well-known restaurant that's been around for a long time, and it's a well-known chef, and then not really jumping on the bandwagon of, okay, let's change our menu. Let's now cater to this, kind of going through that whole fad, if you want to call it, until that passes, and until people maybe circle back, or you can just kind of maintain that food throughout.
A good example of the Alinea Group with Alinea's menus and their other restaurant Next, the one that changes its concept every 3-4 months. Some of the Next menus, they say, we are not able to accommodate gluten-free on this menu, or we're not able to kind of this on that menu. So they do what they can, but they also let people know up front, if this is a major concern for you, this menu is not for you.
Yeah. Phil, are you a particular eater? And what I mean by this is, and my wife can attest to this, when I go to a restaurant and you're going to pay a decent penny, you kind of want what you want. And sometimes I don't stick to the menu a lot. Like, I'll see something I like, but then I'll vary from that and be like, hey, could you add this or take away that?
Mm-hmm.
And when a restaurant tells me no, I get very upset by that.
Yeah. A waiter should never utter the word no under any circumstances.
See?
Unless you're saying, are you having a heart attack right now? And he can say, no, I'm not.
Right.
Okay, that's good. I'd be able to say that. But the the three responses to a question, yes, no question, are yes, I'll check with the chef, and I'll find out. Those are your answers.
Yes.
As a server, I would never put it on myself to tell a customer no. I'm getting Mr. Top Toke back there. You tell him no. I'm not. What can we do? What can we do?
And right.
It's a rare circumstance where a chef can't accommodate something like that.
That's my point. Is like, I think if you're not accommodating that, you're kind of a jerk.
Well, I think sometimes it's probably more often the server than the chef. So if it's an inexperienced server who maybe is timid or doesn't know the answer, instead of saying something like, I'll check, I think they sort of get flustered and don't know the answer and don't have the experience or skills to know what to do, which they should in a restaurant. So maybe they need to be trained a little bit more.
We're that couple.
Or the chef is a tyrant, and you know better to ask him any questions.
Absolutely, and maybe they're afraid.
I'm without the Wicked Witch of the South's bloom, I am not going and talking to this guy because he gets mad at me.
Or like if you have shrimp on the lunch menu, and you know you got shrimp in the back, and I want shrimp instead of chicken, but you'll say no because. That kind of stuff irks me about restaurants.
Yeah. Does that happen a lot?
The reason I'm saying this, you ever been to Altiero? Yeah, there's one in LaGrange, and I think there's another one in
Geneva.
Okay, no.
And it's a Latin fusion restaurant, and it's fantastic. The flavors, Phil, you should check it out, are out of this world. So we went there. We go to several times for dinner. But they do this weird concept where they change ownership during the day, and then at night it becomes a different restaurant.
It's a timeshare restaurant?
It's basically a timeshare restaurant. Really.
Interesting.
That's what I said, too. We didn't know that, so we went in there one day for lunch, and I wanted what was on the dinner menu.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady's like, no, I'm sorry. I'm like, what do you mean? This is Altiero, right? She's like, yeah, but it's a different owner during the day, a different menu. I'm like, but you have shrimp back there, right? Yeah. We just can't make that.
Right. Because it's the other chef's shrimp.
Right. don't you dare touch that. That's not your refrigerator.
That's my refrigerator. There's a lock on the door, and you can stay away from my shrimp because I'm running shrimp next week.
Have you heard of concepts like that?
I have never heard of that.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
That's fascinating.
Check it out.
One place does the lunch, and then a whole different everything.
Two partners, and they basically share the space, which, you know, kind of makes sense if you think it from a business standpoint, but from a logistics standpoint.
Hey, you'd think they could share a shrimp.
You think they could share a shrimp, right? Or make me my dinner. I want that dinner for lunch.
Now, that said, I will say that some chefs put their menus together with very, very specific decisions having been made.
Yeah.
They think this goes exactly with that, and that goes exactly with that, and they've worked like crazy to get that exactly timed, and then somebody says, you know, can I have this without the puttanesca sauce, but with extra shrimp? And could you put some garlic on toast to make that for me,
yeah,
too? Sometimes that kind of, depending on how the operation runs, depending on how many people are back there, that can affect how flexible they can be on a busy night. So
I get it.
I'll give them that.
That makes sense because I'm thinking about it. Food is a very specific, you have a palate for it and you like different flavors. But if, you know, you being a designer, if someone will say to you, well, you know what, I like those colors, but I like the other color more.
You know what I would say?
It doesn't really go together.
You're paying for it. I'll do whatever you want.
But what if you knew it didn't go well together?
You're not going in my book.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not going on the resume, but I will do this in pink polka dots. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God. So how far in advance do you plan out your visits?
About 6 weeks.
6 weeks? So
I mean, the first time I go into a restaurant, the review will probably show up more than a month later.
And you're published weekly or daily?
Yeah, weekly.
Weekly. Nice. And then how long does it take you to write the articles leading up?
Well, it depends on the article, but I spent a day on it.
That's cool. I'd love that job.
I mean, do a lot of people say that to you? Like, wow,
everybody
your job is amazing.
Yeah. Right. My standard answer
is it really?
Everybody wants my job for 2 weeks, and then they'll give it back to me. Because, you know, the only bad thing about this job is you can never tell anybody what's bad about the job because nobody wants to hear it.
Right. What is bad about the job?
What's bad about the job is that I'm socializing on a Friday and Saturday night is very difficult for me and has for more than 20 years. Because,
I mean, outside of work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you want to socialize with me, you want to come along and go to dinner. By the way, I'm picking the place and I'm picking the time and I'm going to tell you what you're allowed to order. So this will be fun.
That sounds fun to me, to be honest with you.
It does, but it gets old, I would imagine.
Yeah. And if you're inviting people with you, are they paying for half the bill or are you treating?
Well, it depends. But
depends on who it is, probably.
But and how the budget's looking that week. But sometimes sometimes I can't pick the whole thing up.
Well,
you're paying for the wine.
How does that work? Do the restaurants comp you or?
No.
And you don't tell them you're coming?
Mm-mm. For many, many years, I didn't have my face out there or anybody could do. So
yeah.
We're closing in on the 1 year anniversary of my virtual unmasking.
Coming out, so to speak.
So are you afraid that, like, in the kitchen, like your pictures posted up in the kitchen?
Yeah, you got a wanted sign in the back of every kitchen now.
Frankly, that was true before.
True.
Really?
Yeah. I heard every now and then when I'm getting ready to write the review, we send one of our photographers over to get specific pictures and do all that. So by the time the photographer shows up, I'm already finished with my eating. And every now and then a photographer will take a quick shot of what they've got posted in the back room and show it to me.
That
they got
amazing.
You.
That's great.
They got you.
Same with smartphones today. Everyone's got, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I was at a restaurant once. I was watching a bartender. I said, he's trying to take my picture. He's over there. It's like,
yeah, like seriously?
I can't do this all night.
Well, I'm sure you like. I like to hear comments like this, like from the 414. All of my Chicago reservations I get from Phil. I mean, that's got to be the upside of your job.
It really is. It really is.
To hear comments like that.
And mm-hmm.
Do people ever like email you and lambast you about a review? And
well, I get criticism. I have a criticism in my phone today about the restaurant we're talking about because I said that there were, you know, sufficient choices, plenty of choices in the pre-feast menu at Silencieux. There are five entrees, five appetizers. You can make a meal. And he thought that five choices in each category was minuscule and unacceptable. So he was not happy.
You tell him that you don't own the restaurant?
I haven't gotten back to him. I just got this like an hour ago.
Do you respond to people?
Usually.
Yeah. That's nice.
Nice.
Phil Vitale, thanks for coming in, buddy.
My pleasure.
Where can people find you on social and online?
Social is I'm just Phil Vitale. I mean, that's even Twitter is at Phil Vitale and Chicago Tribune. It's chicagotribune.com/dining. And
nice.
I'm lurking around there somewhere.
Can you sneak peek what's coming up next week?
Next week, we are going to be looking at the at a recent surge in Middle Eastern fine dining restaurants.
Nice.
And that, and not only they, a few popped up, but they've proven to be extremely popular. And trying to put my finger on that pulse and see what's going on.
Nice. Fantastic. We'll be following. Thanks, Phil.
Thanks. Thank you.